This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with aviation journalist Mary Kirby about the passenger experience. Mary's the founder, editor, and publisher of Runway Girl Network. In the news, we look at ATC privatization, drones and wildfires, Air France's new airline targeted at millennials, congressional action to address airline seat size and pitch, and airline revenue from fees and frequent flyer programs. All that and a lot more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 462 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Brian Coleman. He's our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. 2 weeks in a row. Yay, me.
Yeah.
No travel for me.
That's good. We're glad you're with us.
Yeah.
Yes. Also here is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian. He blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. Hello to everybody and those out having a good time in central Wisconsin. Looking forward to a good show. One of our favorite guests is on it tonight.
That's right. And our guest is Mary Kirby. Mary, as most of you know, has covered the aviation industry for almost 20 years now as both a journalist and an editor. She worked for Flight Global for many years and launched Runway Girl Network, which delivers news and intelligence about the airline passenger experience industry. And it also highlights the work and accomplishments of women in aviation. Runway Girl Network, it really is a go-to site, and they really encompass a very interesting B2B2C model. Mary, welcome back to Airplane Geeks.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's such a pleasure to have you here. Of course, Mary and I get to talk to each other frequently on the PaxX podcast, so we figured it was time to bring Mary back. Mary, tell us a little bit about Runway Girl Network in terms of what it has grown to become.
Yeah, you know, we launched in November 2013 was our soft launch. We did a hard launch in the beginning of the year 2014, and it has grown rather rapidly. We're kind of moving from strength to strength. We've seen traffic take off. We've seen the contribution from journalists around the world get stronger and better, and they're quite prolific, some of them. We've been able to broaden our coverage a little bit to include multimedia facets, of course, the podcast. We have a PaxX TV show. Let's just say there's never a dull moment, Max. We are constantly rolling. And for me right now, it's a lot of work. It's a seven day a week job.
Sure.
That I love. It's a labor of love. But it's definitely keeping us very, very busy.
Oh, I'm sure. And for those of you who haven't seen it, you should visit runwaygirlnetwork.com. And this is a professional site. Again, if you haven't seen it, this is not the work of just Mary penning a very nice blog. It's much more comprehensive than that. And as Mary said, many, many writers and contributors. It's just a huge wealth of information. You also have a newsletter.
We do. We have a weekly newsletter that kind of rounds up everything. And but one of the interesting things that we're finding, Max, is that the site is now serving as a bit of an archive for the passenger experience industry.
Hmm.
So we're getting kind of more and more people that are considering PaxX for careers, using Runway Girl Network now as an educational tool. That's
very
kind of the most exciting part that I've noticed of late, where we get kind of even doctoral students reaching out for information and guidance and whatnot. And for me, that's, let's say that's the icing on the cake.
It's
really something I'm very, very proud of.
Yes, yes. And you should be proud of it. All right. Well, why don't we launch into the aviation news from the past week first? So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Our first item, we wanted to mention something interesting, a development in the ATC privatization issue that we've been talking about for, oh, at least the last few episodes, if not longer. And this is an article, it comes from AOPA, Sully mobilizes pilots against ATC privatization. And I don't know, I thought this was very interesting. It's a 31-second ad, so it's very short. It's available at atcnotforsale.com. We'll have a link to it also, of course, in the show notes. And we have Sullenberger. Sully says that privatizing ATC would hand, quote, control to the largest airlines, giving them the keys to the kingdom. So, again, I thought that was interesting. I was a little surprised to see Sully jumping into this. I don't know. Maybe it's entirely within his character, but I think it certainly lends a different, voice to the arguments against privatizing air traffic control coming from somebody as notable as Sully. What did you guys think? Were you surprised by this?
I kind of was, but I'm happy to see that he jumped in. I think it's oftentimes difficult for people that have certain notoriety or fame to take a stance, but this is something that he did. And yes, I'm kind of glad to see him step up.
You know, we've had some discussion about this topic in our Slack team. As you know, there is a website that you can visit, govt.eaa.org, which makes it very easy to send your elected officials here in the U.S., your thoughts on this privatization issue. And we've been getting some interesting responses back from various elected officials. Some folks have been posting those in our Slack team. I think in the listeners' mail section at the end of the show, we've got another example of that. And it really runs the gamut, I think. Some of the elected officials, some of the Congress people are committed one way or the other, but most of them seem to be kind of waiting a little bit, still kind of forming their opinions. So they value the input from the constituency, but haven't firmly committed. And as at least one of them pointed out, you know, there's a lot of issues in the reauthorization bill besides this one.
You're being too kind. They're being ambivalent.
Some of them are.
We've seen a lot of it where it's like, that's not my problem or my committee. Don't worry about it. I don't know why that is, but maybe because we have other things going on in the universe.
Whichever position you hold, and I'm not saying that everybody who listens to this podcast is against ATC privatization. From the feedback we've gotten, I would say that that's pretty strongly the majority. But either way, I would say that it is important to contact your elected officials and let them know how you feel, even if they're ambivalent or not very responsive, because at least it helps get the message across as to where the folks that hire them are coming from on this issue.
Yeah, and or even make them aware of the issue or just move it up in their priority.
Are you saying I need to send Bill Schuster a letter then?
Ah, now isn't Bill Schuster, isn't he, doesn't he represent you, Mary?
Yes, he's 9th District. Well, he's out here in, the Everett, Bedford, Altoona kind of area. He's kind of well known, shall we say, and this is an area I spend a lot of time in. But this is a very kind of red area, if you were. So I suspect it largely support what Bill is doing, given that he's managed to get reelected over and over, whether some of us like it or not. But
yes.
I might be sending him a letter.
Oh, that'd be a great idea.
Not my side of the state.
Yeah,
not
Dave.
My side of the state.
Dave is in the clear. All right. Well, another issue that comes up in the news a lot and continues to come up is not only the wildfires that we're seeing in the western U.S., but also interference by drones to the firefighting efforts. We have an article in azcentral.com, which is actually, I think, part of USA Today. This is drones continue to cause problems for wildfire crews. Brian, this is something that's kind of close to home for you, isn't it?
Yeah, well, fortunately, the hills behind me aren't burning this year, but they could go up at any moment. We did have a lot of rain, therefore an awful lot of brush. I believe there are 23 active fires in California right now. One of them in Santa Barbara was burning before I went to Germany, and it's still burning today. So that's almost 3 weeks. And having people fly their drones to ground the firefighters, it's just really sad. It really gets in the way, and people have lost an awful lot of houses. They've lost all their possessions just to get some aerial shots with a drone. I just don't think it's worth it, and I wish that they would keep their drones away from the firefighting area.
Yeah, this is certainly something that we talk about on the UAV Digest frequently. You really like to sort of smack these folks upside the head. And oftentimes they're not kids. They're adults who you would think should know better. But, they're after some great videos, some exciting footage. They get out there with their drones. And, of course, when they're in the airspace, you can't have the aerial tankers, the spotting planes, the helicopters, all of that kind of thing going on. They get grounded. David, this is something we've talked about a lot.
Ironically, on our last episode of Digest, we talked about a program where they're instituting drones to put out the fires being flown by fire. So maybe there'll be a turn of phrase, but you can't fix stupid, like I've said on airplane on UAV Digest. There's two different types of people. We've talked about this. There are people who are dumb, and there are people who are stupid. People who are dumb are people who don't know any better and don't realize that the $200 that they forked over for a drone can cause such havoc over a wildfire. Then there are people who are stupid who should know better and are flying and have no regard for what they're doing. Hopefully we can continue to mitigate the "if you fly, we don't" motto of a lot of the Western states. But it's still education. We got to keep educating these people that this is not the time to be flying drones. And, you know, we've had people say, "Well, I was trying to be helpful." You're not helping. If the fire departments want your help, they'll come get you. So it's a tough call. I empathize with Brian. And all of those people out there, but I don't know how to quite fix the problem. It's an education problem, and we've been working on it for years. Even if that even becomes 100% successful, it's not going to negate the people who will do it purposefully, you know, and are bad seeds.
Yeah.
Well, David, here's one for you. One of the other stories that I submitted was about how drones could be used by the firefighters to aid in the battling of the forest fires. And I think that that's good, that if they're using them for good and aiding to put out the fires, that's great. But I also think that it could encourage other people, if they see a drone up in the air, they don't necessarily know that it's Cal Fire's drone, for example, and then they decide to launch their drone and muck up the works through that as well.
Well, so that goes back to, we need to continue to educate people. It's a tough call. It's a very democratized way of flying. It's not hard to get a drone and go flying. You need to be able to educate people on how to fly properly. And trying to do that is one thing, but it's really tempting to get high visibility, high resolution photos of wildfires and then post it on the internet. Unfortunately, luckily, most people who do that will get in trouble, but it's a very difficult, we got to keep pushing out. UAS industry is working very hard to get out the proper message to everyone. But again, you can't fix bad actors. There's people who will fly a drone and not know any better. There's people who fly a drone deliberately. And yeah, they're just as bad as the arsonist who starts the wildfire. We need to have enforcement, and then we need to have education. It's like everything else on the planet.
That sounds exactly like the prescription that's needed for the laser pointer issue as well. That's immediately what comes to my mind. Yeah. It sounds so akin.
Yeah, very similar in many respects. Brian, you were talking about how drones might be used to support fighting these wildfires. And in that episode of the UAV Digest that David mentioned, episode 203. Yeah, we spoke with Liz Stalford, who's the FAA UAS test range manager for the Warm Springs test range. And there's some interesting activity going on there with regard to testing. One of the applications that she talked about was the fact that when you have a wildfire and you have all these aircraft supporting the, you know, fighting that fire, they're flying during the day, not at night. And the fire, of course, doesn't take the night off. And what they're looking at is using drones during night when you're not flying manned operations to continue to survey the fire, use thermal imaging and so forth, so that you know, when everyone wakes up in the morning ready to fight the fires again, they'll have much more current information, much better assessment of the condition of the fire and so forth. So that was an interesting approach, I think. It also avoids the, you know, how do you mix manned and unmanned aircraft into the same airspace issue by saying, you know, manned aircraft during the day, unmanned aircraft during the night. So it's sort of an interesting way to approach that.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about another something new that's interesting, I think. And there's been a few articles in the news about a new airline coming from Air France called, I guess we'd call this Joon, J-O-O-N. And Air France describes Joon as a carrier focused on millennials. They say it's aimed at a young working clientele whose lifestyles revolve around digital technology. They say that this is not going to be a low-cost airline, but it is going to cater to this sort of young crowd. Interesting concept. Mary, when you saw this, did you think that this is an interesting idea or something that's kind of crazy?
I mean, I guess immediately I thought of TED, the kind of airline within the airline, yeah. Which has been a bit of a failed model. So I have to say the whole thing seems a bit cloying to me, if you know what I mean. But I'm not alone in feeling this way. In fact, right before we started recording, I got the chance to read a post that Cranky Flyer has just published called "The Consultants Have Won. Air France's new airline is named Joon," and essentially, you know, suggests that it was thrown over to a bunch of wayward consultants who have made a horrible, horrible mistake here. I think he makes some really, really good points in this piece. And this kind of focused attention on the millennial doesn't necessarily seem like the best of business, actually.
I love how she says that with this disdain, millennial.
Sorry, oh, you Mary, know, I
but,
have...
but just it's sort of like we're not that far away from those, Mary. You know that.
We're just kind of skating the edge, aren't we?
Yeah. However, like I said on the last show, on my flight back from Germany, and I had the millennial sitting next to me that was just going crazy because she couldn't get on the in-flight entertainment system. Yeah. So here, now they're advertising to millennials. This reinforces that I will never buy a ticket on this airline.
But Mary, what's the logic? Is there really a market out there?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, their group of consultants obviously thinks that there is. You know, one of the things, and I have to say, you know, having read Brett's piece as well, that he points out, is that they're kind of using all of these kind of catchwords, you know, millennials, connected, all of this. And it doesn't necessarily seem like they are 100% knowledgeable as to what their business plan ultimately is going to be either. And of course, you know, it's all kind of contingent on ensuring that costs are in place. So no, I think there's a big question mark with respect to this airline. And of course, that doesn't even get into the passenger experience side of things. There's very few details released. They're saying more is coming in September. But right now, it's a real big question mark. And like I said, I think, you know, it harkens back to this kind of low-cost airline within an airline. It's been tried before to various degrees of success and some absolute failure. Like Ted, it will be interesting to see.
But Mary, I thought part of this airline was to compete with other airlines like Emirates, and they wanted to... Air France is losing market share to more expensive airfares. Therefore, they kind of needed to do a low-cost airline, but this isn't a low-cost airline. So I'm confused over their branding and marketing strategy over this, because they seem to be addressing the wrong problem with this solution.
They do, and it's kind of a bizarre hybrid. It's difficult to understand what the thinking is behind it, and kind of for lack of more information being available. I mean, you've seen the marketing materials around this. It's kind of stunning, the bare bones, like, oh, yeah. look at our idea. Now we're going to go and back behind the, you know, behind the curtain and now go put some meat on the bones, presumably. I definitely want to hear more, but it's unclear.
Yes, yes. And, you know, here's a few sentences from the Air France press release, and this will give you an idea for where we're coming from on this. June is a lifestyle brand and a state of mind. Short, punchy, and international, the name June is designed to address a worldwide audience. Its visual identity is based on an electric blue color code symbolizing the airline's dynamic attitude, as well as the sky, space, and travel. The uniform of June's flight attendants will be inspired by the new fashion codes, basic and chic. So, yeah, I'm yeah.
Okay. That kind of stuff makes me, as a marketer, really embarrassed. I could play BS Bingo and on that, and I mean, I don't know. It's amazing you can string that many buzzwords in one coherent sort of paragraph. Yeah.
I am kind of intrigued, though. I have to admit, you know, even though I have some reservations, and even though it is, as you're saying, Mary, they really have not described this in any real meaningful detail, I am kind of intrigued to see what they come up with. And sometimes, you know, the craziest, most outlandish things that seem unrealistic or not even feasible turn out to, you know, have some interesting elements to them. So I guess we'll see.
Well, look, if the price is right, but again, we need to wait and see.
Yeah.
If the price is right, they'll get the millennials. No problem.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe they'll give each of them a trophy. You know, everybody gets a trophy.
Oh, wow.
You flew.
Oh, man. I've got to like fight you on that, Max, or like I'm going to get like emails.
Uh-oh. All right. Let's
moving on.
Moving on. Let's come back to the SEAT Act. This is from a Yahoo article. Congress set to finally push back against shrinking airline seats. We've talked about this. We've speculated that if seat pitch, seat size continues to shrink, and as consumers become more and more, well, irate even in some cases, that, you know, maybe Congress will take some action, whether it's well-advised or ill-advised. And what we have here is something called the Safe Egress in Air Travel Act, or the SEAT Act, S-E-A-T. And this is introduced by Representative Steve Cohen, Democrat from Tennessee. And this is introduced as an amendment to the FAA reauthorization bill. And it would not regulate seat size per se, but it looks at it more from a safety standpoint. And the under this amendment, the FAA would be required to study evacuations and issue regulations for minimum safe seat sizes. So it comes at it from a safety standpoint. What do you think, Brian? You think this is something that's got legs?
Yeah, so to speak.
I can't believe he put in the show notes, it's pitched as a safety regulation.
Yeah, rather than a comfort legislation.
No, it's always been one of the things that I've harped on for a really long time. When I fly, I want to make sure that my butt gets safely to a destination. And if I can't get out of a plane because there's a 28-inch seat pitch or my fellow seatmates block me from getting out, I honestly have an issue with that. It's real interesting. The article talks about in the 70s where the seat pitch on average was 35 inches. Now it certainly seems like it's 30, 31 inches. I don't know, Mary, do they recertify aircraft when they add more rows?
You know, what's really unfortunate is they are recertifying the aircraft to take more seats, but they're accepting simulation testing instead of real life evacuation testing. And this is something, it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart because I bang this drum on the PAX6 podcast a lot, poor Max. But here we go again, Max. Yep. No, I mean, it's really highly concerning to me that both FAA and EASA do certify now these high density LOPAs, these high density aircraft configurations using simulation testing. They're just using the computers, what the computers say. Now, to me, that's not enough. So I actually think that going about this from a safety angle is actually the smarter way of going about it because we really don't know. We really don't know if you have a true mix of passengers that is representative, you know, of today's, the modern passenger. That includes elderly, people with reduced mobility, you know, it includes a mix. Will they be able to evacuate from these, particularly these ultra high density seating configurations, which, like you said, Brian, when you're talking about an aircraft filled with 28 inch pitched seats? I'd like to know as a passenger, and I think it would be right and fair to start demanding some better data before decisions are made. And I don't think that we can make any of those decisions until we know, and we just don't know. Now, the last time I checked in with the FAA was a while ago, and they said that their medical institute was looking at doing some real-world evacuation testing. That's the last that we've heard of it. But it's definitely something that we want to see happen in industry. And I will say this, I interviewed a company that does, that aids various different passenger experience corporations in gaining certification for a variety of different systems and solutions and whatnot. And they said that, and now they wouldn't tell me the name of the company, but they said that one of their clients was looking to privately do its own evacuation testing with live people, because they wanted that extra security beyond what they were seeing from the data that they were getting from their simulation tests. But again, the FAA and EASA are accepting simulation. Now, they made an exception for the Airbus A380 because it was a unique design. And of course, they did have a kind of a real live, you know, evacuation. But as we've reported and kind of said many times, 50% of them were Airbus employees that participated, and 50% of them were pulled from the local gym. And they were also prepared for it, you know?
Yeah, they
were
also given
a lot of, they knew it was coming. They were educated about it. They knew what they were supposed to do. You know, I mean, of course, the question becomes, what's the liability of actually doing real world testing? Could you get people to sign up to do it in the name of, you know, safety and science? I think you probably could with the right incentives and the right disclaimers. But I do think something needs to be done because I don't want my safety as a passenger and those of other passengers to be reliant wholly on what the computer says right now. I don't.
Yeah, but what decade would it be that United, Delta, or American paid to have a real-world test done?
No, but the FAA would. FAA would.
Well, it's still, on occasion, it's still done. Like I said, there's still, I mean, it's not being broadcast, but there are still, you know, companies out there that will do it quietly for their own use. But no, I mean, the very latest, I mean, I remember we even wrote a piece about this a couple years ago when the A320 was recertified to be able to take more seats. I think it was 15 more seats. And EASA just said, okay, we accept your simulation. And that's that.
I know I can't get out of 28 pinch in a hurry. Yeah, Mary and I have that issue where, you know, I don't move quickly now to begin with anymore since my surgery. So I would have real trouble getting out of an aircraft in a hurry. Usually I sit still on the airplane till everybody else gets off so I can get off comfortably. Because normally it takes a while to get your legs out from them being wedged in the seat in front of you.
Would you be willing to participate in the test?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would. Amen. Yeah. Hands up. For sure. For sure. I mean, when you're sitting side saddle on these seats, I mean, I do you find yourself in that situation, David? I'm literally having to go side saddle with some of these seats.
Yeah, I was sort of dumbfounded when I flew in January that it was sort of, and I don't have the flexibility anymore to do that. So it's sort of, you know, it's And the airline's answer is, well, just pay for more legroom. That's fine. And I don't even mind. I'll even volunteer to do a emergency door because I know I can handle that. But still, it's really difficult for a common person. You know, I'm not a normal size. I'm 6'4". You know, and I have a 38-inch inseam. There's no way that those legs fit in any cabin.
Yeah, no, I know. But I'm not a normal size for a woman. You know, I have a 37-inch leg seam and I'm 6 foot tall. I'm finding it very difficult as well, to the point, and I know we're going to talk about it a little later, but to the point where it's no longer an option for me to fly any length of serious time in economy class without proper legroom. I mean, I can't do it. It becomes a health concern for me. It's so uncomfortable, and I get off these aircraft and I feel like I'm almost hobbled. I mean, it's just a horrible feeling to fly long haul now in some of these tight configurations, and I just don't see it as an option.
Yeah, Mary, I think the good thing is at least all four of us aren't over. We are not people of size in the width category. We might be tall, but at least we're not wide.
So although I'm working on it.
But, you know, and no offense, Brian, at one point I was 260 pounds.
Right. But well, since I've known you, you're not. But so now my point is, throw in a bunch of oversized people into this mix with mobility issues with a 28 or less seat pitch. That's what I'm concerned about getting off the aircraft with.
Your egress situation. Well, that's why we would need real world testing, really. And also passengers of size to participate in that testing. But I agree with you. That is a concern. It's a concern because passengers in general are, I mean, I know it sounds very PC, but we are genuinely getting taller and we are genuinely getting wider. That's reality,
yes.
You know, and these seats are genuinely not accommodating increasingly the size.
And the environment we're talking about is a cabin filled with smoke or a cabin where you're disoriented, you know, I mean.
And half of the exit doors not operating,
we're not talking about getting out, climbing up. And as the plane hasn't even reached the gate yet, you're standing up, getting your luggage and your overhead like a lot of people do. We're talking about an emergency egress, which is a completely different ball game. And I would love to find out what they use to model. I mean, is it standardized one size fits all, which would really be scary?
Well, for example, for the 16G test that the seats have to go through, for example, they use a kind of a standard dummy, which is a 5'10" male. I actually liken some of the guys that that write for me, including Seth Miller and Jason Rabinowitz, they serve as what we call PaxX models very good because they are relatively similar in size to the dummies that are used in the crash tests. and so it actually works out really well to be able to size up these seats. And, you know, I was struck by a picture of Seth Miller, who is an average-sized guy, dummy-sized guy, remarkable in other ways, but dummy-sized guy, sitting in, a 737 seat, and his shoulders being broader than the seat. Now you put three guys together, you know where that's at, just in terms of just how broad their shoulders are. That doesn't even include bellies and legs and everything else. So, you know, it feels like the passenger experience from the just very specific seat standpoint is not evolving as the human body is changing. I mean, look around. I mean, we can call it whatever you want, but we are collectively getting to be bigger. We're bigger humans, and there's nothing wrong with that. We're bigger. But now, you know, we need to think about what does that mean for that tube.
Not to mention now we have laptops. You know, do you remember the good old days when your in-flight entertainment was look out the window and the deck of cards the airline provided you?
I disagree on this, on what's good in-flight entertainment, David.
We've learned to agree and disagree. But, you know, I want to work, too. I want to throw open my laptop, and I can't really type when the laptop is in my gut. You know, it's sort of like, it's like at this point, it's like, why try to work on the airplane? Because there's no room to work.
Right. But now if it's an emergency situation and everyone has their iPad or tablet device out and they lose control of that as the whatever happens to the plane happens, now you have all these trip hazards in the aisleway. And, you know, sure, the deck of cards could have been a slip hazard, but I think that they were much safer than having all these electronics thrown about.
And a lot of those electronics are plugged into power, and increasingly the power is in front of you and not below the seat, because the living space is so tight that it's difficult for passengers to navigate mm-hmm. and get under that seat and try and find the power source. And so increasingly they're putting obviously the USB in front. That means you've got the cabling, and then in an egress situation, mm-hmm. what does that mean? You know, so you've got not only the devices, but you've got tripping hazard on top of that. And that stuff that, by the way, you know, is kind of getting, it's not getting the attention that it deserves. It's not for lack of highlighting. We've done it on Runway Girl Network. We've highlighted all of these issues we're talking about. But
And now, of course, you're talking about electric seats or electric chairs.
Right. And then those tablets getting crushed in them, which is a fire hazard. And we have seen what a severe fire hazard that is. I mean, even Air France had something like 3 or 4 incidences where these tablets and PEDs were getting stuck down the back of their business class seat and getting crushed and creating smoke and fire events on board. They had a real problem there for a while on their 777s. So this is an issue on so many levels. I mean, every single level. And are our regulators paying close enough attention? You know, I'd argue that they are not. Now, I would argue that the FAA is not, rather, and EASA is not. But are the representatives or the legislators that are pushing now for this legislation, are they doing it because they're truly concerned about safety, or are they concerned about their own comfort when they're flying back to their own districts? That's what I want to know.
Yes. Do they care? I don't care. Either way, it works for me. If I could avoid it, if he gets it to a 30-inch seat pitch and I can actually sit, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I wondered about the motivation as well.
I don't think you're going to be able to regulate around comfort, but I think that they know that. And I think that, you know, those that have tried repeatedly know you're not going to regulate around comfort. So now they're coming at it from a safety standpoint. But you can't even regulate around safety until you have the data, and you can't have the data until you start testing some of this stuff and using people and using real world scenarios like the one we just described with tablets and cords and everything else.
The bill itself is very short. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. It'll take you about 3 minutes to read the entire bill. It's very short. Just a couple of points, though, and then we'll move on. One of them is that in addition to directing the FAA to take a look at establishing minimum space standards for passengers, it would require that air carriers post on their websites prominently information relative to seat pitch and width and all of those things as well. And then the other point I'd make is that it specifically says that in prescribing the regulations required under this bill, the FAA would consult with OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, passenger advocacy organizations, physicians, and ergonomic engineers. So I thought that was kind of an interesting collection of those who would be required to participate in this survey. I mean, in this study, and it is sort of more safety related than comfort related. Although OSHA and obviously passenger advocacy organizations would be interested in that as well. So it would be kind of interesting to see if this thing were to be enacted, and again under the sort of the banner of safety, if that remained the focus, or if these other comfort issues also got drawn in. It'd be hard, I think, to separate those two.
Agreed.
All right. Just really quick, maybe Brian, you can kind of summarize this. This is an article from Travel Skills, which airlines earn most from fees and frequent flyer programs. It was kind of interesting, a little bit of an eye-opening article. Maybe you can tell us what this is about, Brian.
Yeah, it sure was. So there's data from 2016 where they had airlines from around the world, the quantity of revenue that they generate from sources other than selling the tickets. And the big categories, as you could imagine, are the frequent flyer program, baggage fees and then other travel-related services. And I'm assuming, I couldn't see from the article, but I'm assuming that's where if you buy a cruise from the airline's website or you rent a car or book your hotel stay, there are commissions that the airline gets as a result of doing those other travel-related services. And I certainly found it really interesting that in order, it was United, Delta, and American making the most money, and United making a little over $6 billion. And I know we've talked about on the show before just how profitable frequent flyer programs are and how they're selling their miles, mostly to credit card companies. You know, United got 48% of this revenue, so approximately $3 billion by selling miles. And I find that just a fascinating number. And some of the other carriers on the list, you're looking at people like Air Canada at 45% through the frequent flyer, or KLM Air France at 33%. Boy, they sure have a lot of work to do to start selling their frequent flyer miles and make some more money like everyone else.
And when you factor out the frequent flyer miles, the list becomes different, right? You have a different picture. And you see airlines like Spirit at the top, Frontier, Allegiant, Wizz Air. The list is organized differently depending on which factors you include in the analysis. So, yeah, it is really kind of an interesting view.
Yeah, so I just thought this was fun, and it reinforces the point that we've been making all along, that there's an awful lot of profitability in selling miles. And I think if you were to take away these revenue sources, this is a reasonable chunk of profit from the airlines.
Absolutely.
And they're absolutely making money outside of just selling tickets.
Again, we're speaking with Mary Kirby. She's the founder, editor, and publisher of Runway Girl Network. Mary, again, so good to have you on the show.
Oh, this is fun. I'm having a good time.
great. You certainly cover, you and the network certainly covers a lot of different topics, and we've talked about many of them even to this point, this episode, but there are many, many, many more. But if you sort of step back and kind of look more broadly at the passenger experience, the PAXX landscape, are there some issues that kind of float to the top for you in terms of, I don't know, their impact or just what's going on with them this year?
Well, I would tell you this, what is happening in seating, it gets tremendous attention now. And that has been, it's very noteworthy that the passenger is getting a little bit more educated. Now, you guys are all obviously aviation experts and enthusiasts, and you know you're what to look for when you're getting ready to fly. But even the infrequent traveler is starting to ask some of those questions about what their experience is going to look like. And so I think that that's a notable point in time where we're really starting to see. Now, my question has been, and it has been for the last number of years, is there a lowest common denominator? How low can you go? You know, we're seeing some airlines pushing it. They're really pushing it with that tight seating configuration. And of course, and we've talked about on the PAXX podcast, Max, we see seats now that are being pitched at 27 inches on the show floors of the Aircraft Interiors Expos. So they're preparing for the even kind of higher density world of seats at 27 inches, because bar a few countries, there aren't actually any real hard and fast rules about that. Now, the UK has kind of a 28-inch standard. You know, so if you're a Ryanair and you'd be trying to fly into the UK with less than that, you'd run into a bit of problems. But this is where we're at right now, is that there's a real now focus on what does the seating look like. And I think this is why you're starting to see, of course, and I know we're going to talk about it, but the kind of extra legroom products and, of course, premium economy coming on, because passengers are really getting squeezed. And those who have to fly with any kind of regularity, it almost becomes where it's not even, you know, part of the equation. You just can't fly like that regularly and then expect to be able to go and get your work done on the other end without going through a day and night of recovery. So
And Mary, isn't really getting squeezed from both directions? Because not only is the seat pitch decreasing, the width of the seats is also decreasing. I'm thinking of the 777 now at 10 abreast configurations.
Yeah, so unfortunate that the 777 obviously is now increasingly standard at 10 abreast. That, of course, wasn't the case before, but it is now. And that is a very tight seat. And we hear passengers complain about it regularly. Of course, the Boeing 787, which was sold as a kind of a dreamy 8 abreast, well, of course, the lion's share of airlines went with 9 abreast. And people are reporting that as being an agonizing experience. I mean, we, you know, are kind of resident aircraft interiors expert John Walton wrote a piece called Why I Don't Recommend People Fly in the 787. And he spelled out the reason why, you know, that these seats are, you know, really narrow and the living space is just not there. And you feel like you're kind of in on top of each other. And the responses that we get, number one, this story remains in our top 10 every single day. When I look at traffic, this story is in the top 10. That's how much it resonates with people, even years later, even years after it was originally published. People are still commenting on it. There are people that are flying on the 9 abreast 787, having a miserable experience and vowing then never to fly on it again. Now, there's always going to be a whole new wave of people that have yet to experience it that, you know, you've got fresh customers to abuse. So there's going to be a period of time where that is still, that education is going to take place. But my question is, at what point will we start to see a shift where people will say, no, you know, this has gone too far? Is there a point? Because there are certainly airlines out there that are interested in seeing things going tighter. And even, as you know yourself, stand-up seats. Years ago, I know Ryanair, you know, talked about that and got the headlines for that. And Michael O'Leary is full of many times. And that was, well, that was one of them. But even as he was talking up a big game, you had Spring Airlines in China with an entire warehouse dedicated to studying stand-up seats. So it's not this sort of pie-in-the-sky situation. You have folks that would if they could, and the only thing stopping them is certification, or else that's where it would be headed. So yeah, the seat issue is a big one. The 10 abreast 777 comes under harsh scrutiny. The 9 abreast 787 comes under harsh scrutiny. The A350, as you know yourselves, has largely been ordered as the standard 9 abreast, but we have seen one, and Airbus says there are more, carriers that have gone 10 abreast. Now that's down to if we're to believe Airbus's original advertising about this 10 abreast configuration on the A350, you're talking about a 16.4-inch width seat. Wow. Now I'm sorry, I'm a skinny gal, okay? I'm one of those skinny people that people hate because, but who knows, my metabolism may slow down, so, you know, whatever. But I can't even get half an ass cheek in there. I mean, come on.
That's just crazy.
That's just crazy.
Well, you know, I wonder how the airlines approach this strategy, because, I mean, one way to look at it is if it reaches a point where there is a passenger revolt, I mean, if it's a serious one, undoing this becomes prohibitively expensive, I would think. I mean, do the airlines really think that, you know, they can just kind of continue and continue and continue, and they just don't feel like they're close enough to that bottom, that the lowest you can go, and so they don't see themselves in a risky situation yet?
Well, American has kind of tested it out, and there's been some backlash. So, of course, American Airlines, you know, had said that it was looking at doing a few rows with 29-inch pitch, which would be quite the shock for the traveler that's used to flying American. They were going to do that on their new Boeing 737 MAX. So that story hit. John Ostrower, CNN, reported on that. And the backlash was fierce. And passengers were none too pleased. And now American is walking back that plan. But that isn't to say that it's not going to be tried in other iterations. And quite frankly, it's one thing to be talking about what is the experience on these narrow bodies. Now we need to talk about what is the experience on the narrow bodies that are going to be flying kind of long haul transatlantic, right? The re-engine narrow bodies, you get a hole, and this is something else, obviously, that we need to talk about. But you have all of these LCCs that are taking the A320neos and the MAXs, and they're going to be flying transatlantic hops. What does the passenger experience mean on those aircraft? And so we're kind of, yeah, we're in this situation where airlines are kind of testing the waters. And I think American Airlines learned that there was kind of a point where maybe they were pushing too far. But will they try it again? Will others go the same route? I honestly am at that point where I wouldn't put it past them. I wouldn't put it past them at all.
Mary, is this one of the opportunities where the airlines could go ahead and keep the 28, 29-inch seat pitch, but add more premium economy seats and sell those higher margin, higher revenue generating seats?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is ultimately what they're trying to do. They're trying to get you to buy up, you know, and make it. But, you know, I find that in, you know, United Airlines is a good example. When I've bought the Economy Plus, generally I'm okay with that Economy Plus experience, but there have been times where I've purchased Economy Plus, and the seat just feels like kind of what economy, you know, used to feel like. So you're kind of paying for the experience of what economy was in the past. Now that's your Economy Plus experience. That to me is noticeable, and I guess that's noticeable for anyone that has been flying for decades, where you're just like, I paid for Economy Plus, but this is really just an economy seat of, you know, of old.
Yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the other classes? What about the super premium classes, the business class and so forth?
Yeah, well, we have obviously been seeing this kind of shift of, you know, first class. First class hasn't gone the way of the dodo bird yet. There are still airlines that are flying it. It still, you know, has its place right now for some of the kind of flagship products, you know, for the airlines that still want to make a statement for a variety of different reasons. But we are seeing this kind of shift to the business, the premium economy now being that kind of that middle class, and then economy. Which is interesting, because it really tells you a lot about almost how these high density business class seats have evolved. You know, there's the expectation that you're going to have aisle access in business class. There's the expectation that you are going to have a fully flat seat now. And these are kind of considered, this is what you do. If you're going to offer, you know, a proper business class product, these are the boxes that you have to tick. And my colleague, John Walton, feels very strongly about some of these issues. But I'm actually in the camp that, kind of like how I feel about wine, the best wine is the wine you like, you know? The best premium seat is the one that's most comfortable to you. And I'm in the camp, which is a minority, it would seem, that prefers a wider seat, even if it means that I'm going to be denied the aisle access in business class. I would rather the wider seat, and I actually don't mind what John calls the midnight clamor. I don't mind crawling over or straddling a passenger if it means I get an extra inch or two within the seat. But some people prefer a more coffin-like experience to be more enclosed. And so we're seeing a lot of that and a lot of attention being paid to kind of the business class, full flat experience, aisle access experience, the bells and the whistles, but they are high density. You're seeing a lot of high density configurations. Yeah.
What is this United Polaris business class? Is there some controversy surrounding this?
Yeah. So this is the seat that Zodiac, is late in delivering. And of course, Zodiac is on a whole other topic. Zodiac is late in delivering a lot of things right now. They've been having a lot of problems. But this forms the basis of that Polaris seat. And I have to tell you that I haven't had a chance to try the Polaris product yet. Some of our writers have, but I have not personally had that chance. But because of the delays to rolling out, this is called the Optima seat from Zodiac. United has had to kind of offer the soft product, but not the actual physical hard product, which is why it's getting kind of accused of a little bit of a bait and switch of telling passengers you're going to get one thing, and then, of course, them showing up and finding out you get another. Dubbed by John as Folaris, which makes me kind of think of like Folaris. You know, yeah. That is, you know, that's the problem. Now, is it fraud? Some people are suggesting, or you know, is United committing fraud? That's a pretty heavy accusation to make, but I think it's very fair to say that some passengers are quite unhappy about being told that this is what the product was going to be, and yet showing up and just getting the soft side of the product, not the hard product.
Yeah, Mary, I think you're being very generous to United in this regard. In that, their rollout schedule before they had issues obtaining the seats was really, really slow. So they certainly weren't rushing this product to market. And having had the opportunity to fly in Polaris service, but having, I was on 1777 where it was the original business, lie flat business class seat that again, for the first world problem. Don't get
me
wrong.
Right, right, right. You're talking about the diamond seat, then, is what you're referring to?
Yeah, the one without without power in the seat. And it was a terrible seat 20 years ago when they introduced it, or 15 years ago when they introduced it. It's even worse now because they haven't upgraded it. And to be sold this as a Polaris product, to me, that's insulting.
Yeah. Look, I totally hear what you're saying. Like I said, I can appreciate those who feel that way. I mean, when I think United now, you know, I think of a bloodied Asian man. So, you know, to me, this is like, to me, this goes way down that list, because United is like so guilty of such other rather egregious situations. But I get it. It is I wouldn't even say it's a one percenter problem, because there's a lot of people that are flying up front that wouldn't necessarily fall into that category. And you deserve to get what you pay for, or what you think you're paying for. So I get that.
And even part of it's the lounge experience. So if you're talking about the passenger experience, I've mentioned many times, it's not just the experience you have on the plane, but it's from check-in through departure. And when you are sold the concept of the Polaris lounge, and then you find out that there's only one lounge in Chicago, and the other lounges aren't going to be open to the public until well into 2018, they just don't disclose any of this information up front. And I guess that's what I have a problem with.
Yeah. And I have a problem with that industry wide, not just with United, but with virtually every airline and with many of the passenger experience stakeholders. We see a lot of fuzzy press releases. And as journalists, obviously, it's our job to sift through all of that and ask the tough questions. But you also find yourself running into roadblocks. So a good example would be when Southwest Airlines was rolling out its new Meridian seat. It was making claims to Bloomberg, like they had Southwest management on record to Bloomberg claiming that this was going to be the widest 737 seat in North America. And, you know, anyone that had half a critical thinking brain said, well, the fuselage hasn't gotten bigger. So how are you doing this? And they made some ridiculous statements to Bloomberg that proved to ultimately be untrue. And it turned out that all they were doing was really slimming the armrests on these seats and, you know, playing a couple games here to work the numbers, to jig the numbers. And they were literally getting away with making these ridiculous claims, not just in press releases, but to genuine news outlets. So the job of the journalist is so important today. And I would say that to listeners, that if you have a nose for news and you want truth and honest reporting out there, consider the role of journalists, because we need more journalists that are willing to talk about what really is happening out there, because there's a ton of fuzzy press releases. Now, one thing that we do at Runway Girl Network is it's a completely segregated part of our site, but it's called the PR Hub, and it's where it's a depot for press releases about the industry. And it's segregated from our news, but what it's proving to be is that we're now able to go back to press releases that were released a few years ago and compare what was said in the release to what is reality. And so it's going to prove to be a very valuable resource, because a lot of these companies, once they don't like that particular statement anymore, they'll make it disappear from their website. Like bada bing, bada bing. Suddenly the history of the industry is gone. We are maintaining kind of a bit of a history, and we're trying to broaden that out so that we can hold some of these companies to what they claim.
That's really fascinating, because the memory of, well, the general public, but also mainstream press is pretty short. And, you know, today's facts, well, you know, I don't want to, there's too many analogies here that'll get us in trouble. But, you know, what's facts today, you know, may be something different next year. And, and there's a new truth or a replacement truth for it. So, yeah, being able to tie back to
an alternative truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. There you go. But no, it's very much the case. It's very much the challenge for anyone who's trying to deliver real news out there to actually get the real story. But this is where the mobile, social, vocal passenger comes in big time into covering the passenger experience. We are paying attention to what people are saying and what passengers are saying. And what Brian is saying right here about United, as someone who flies United, that is so valid. That's more valid than what me as a journalist who hasn't flown the product is going to say about, oh, well, look at the bells and whistles here, and isn't this interesting, and isn't this nice? What's interesting is what is the real passenger experience. And if that passenger experience feels like a bait and switch to you, that's what matters. So that to me, you know, that's why we're really paying close attention to what the passenger says. And that's why we have a B2B2C model. People say, well, what is that business to business to consumer? We have to maintain that link with the consumer, because then we'll be completely disconnected and we'll just be focused on, well, here's what the corporations say your experience is. Well, no, actually, this is what the passenger says the real experience is. Hmm.
Is that B2B2C model, is that something that evolved in your mind over time, or did you start up Runway Girl Network with that in mind specifically?
Yeah, I did start that up with that in mind, but it had a lot to do with my history, a lot to do with my past. You know, I spent 12 and a half years at Flight, the Flight suite of publications, of which several of those years were focused on their air transport intelligence newswire. And it was called Air Transport Intelligence, and it was rebranded as Flight Global Pro. So when I started doing more and more passenger experience, and I did it for a Runway Girl blog for Flight, and then ultimately launched my own title, I wanted to tie together the intelligence, pulling together and pulling out intelligence about the industry, but also connect that to what the passenger was going through. So, you know, to actually, you know, mixed results. If I was to grade myself right now, I would give myself thus far in terms of where we're at, we've gotten better. I'd say we're pacing at a B right now. I know there's more to do in terms of making that link, making that connection, and pulling both sides together. But that is the goal. That is what we're trying to do at Runway Girl Network.
The network, it continues to amaze me because of, well, the depth and the level of the contributors and the number of contributors. You don't find that anywhere else. I mean, if I think of Mary, who is your competition? There's no one doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Max. I hope that that's the case. I believe that that's the case right now. I believe we have folks that are circling around like sharks that are willing to jump in and give us the run for the money, as it were. But yeah, we pride ourselves on trying to stay on the bleeding edge of this very specific coverage that we're providing. And I think it's important. But I do think that we're going to see more. And I think actually more voices are important. Now, one thing I will say is that I think you have to, in passenger experience, you have to have the humility to admit that you don't know everything, and that to a certain degree, some passenger experience is subjective. So I wouldn't, in a million years, go up against Brian in his knowledge of what it must be like to fly as a United frequent flyer and all of the experiences that he's had. Because I have not had that experience. I'm a U.S. Airways, now American frequent flyer, because I've had to fly out of Philadelphia for all these years.
Hey.
And we'll leave it at that. But my point being that you have to have the humility to hear other people and amplify other people's voices. And I think that that's essential. And I think part of the reason why Runway Girl is growing and moving and shaking is because we believe in amplifying the voices of these increasingly specialized expert journalists. I mean, I have to say, you know, it's amazing to me. I'm amazed at the knowledge that both these men and women have. And all I can say is more please at this point.
And Mary, when you first launched Runway Girl Network, you, I think, really focused on having women journalists. And although you certainly had men at the beginning, I believe the focus was around women, and certainly now you have a lot of men. Are you still focusing, trying to encourage women to get into this as a field and promote them and their accomplishments, or has it just sort of migrated into, well, this is what the market has to offer?
Well, I'm actually really glad you asked me that, because this is something that I'm actually going to be talking about in a presentation in a month or two. But yes, when I launched Runway Girl, I actually launched with all women. Now it didn't stay all women for long, but the goal was to be an all-woman team covering the aviation industry. That was the goal. And in fact, people used to kind of laugh a little bit. They said, "You're Mary, you're going around vacuuming up all the female freelance journalists on the market." I said, "That's exactly right. You know, I'm a feminist. Come on, women, unite." I learned a couple hard lessons early on. Number one is that women that write for Runway Girl Network are in high demand. So this won't surprise you, but some of the rock star women that we are lucky enough to publish their content, we're competing with the likes of USA Today, CNN, Today Show, NBC, ABC. We're competing with mainstream media for them and their work. So that means that I don't get quite as much content as I would like from some of the women that we launched with. And they're still part of the site. They still contribute when they can, but they're in very, very high demand. And I think that I see that as a huge positive. Another aspect that I learned that was a hard lesson with Runway Girl was that, you know, to do this job, you need to be very mobile. You need to be willing to travel. You need to be able to travel around the world. And some women are still very much running their households and taking care of their children and don't necessarily always have the same level of flexibility as the men. And that is the truth. And I will remember, you know, asking some of these women journalists, well, can you go to Brazil? Can you go to New York? Can you do this? Can you do that? And they would have to tell me time and again, no. Well, I need someone to be able to go. And so, yeah, I had to increasingly pull in men. And the reality is that we are now very much a mixed team. However, the core of Runway Girl, the engine of Runway Girl, are women. I work as editor and publisher of Runway Girl, and my right hand, Becca Alkima, who lives in Canada and literally keeps the site running like a well-oiled machine, she and I work hand in glove together. So two women are behind what you see, but obviously we have a lot of bylines that are men and some very, very talented men and women writing for us. And I'm comfortable with that diversity in terms of mix of gender. What I'm not comfortable in is that we don't have enough diversity in terms of people of color. We don't have enough people of color covering the aviation industry. That's an aspect. In addition to wanting to see more women in industry, that's another part of what we want to drive towards in terms of a more diverse industry and more diverse journalism.
Good, very good. I'm going to just mention quickly that Brian has kind of disappointed us this episode. You see, there's been a conspiracy afoot for a new segment for the show. It's called Just One More Question. and that's Brian's chance. No, so because typically what happens, Mary, is after we finish the main topic with our guest, Brian, after we finish the main, I'll repeat that, after we finish the main topic, Brian comes back with just one more question. And the disappointment this episode is that Brian has already asked lots and lots of questions. So so you've kind of taken the fun out of it, Brian. But just on the off chance, I'll just say, Brian, do you have one more question?
Oh, for Mary, I have about 300 questions.
No.
Yeah, no, I could talk with Mary for days and days and days on this topic, because again, to me, passenger experience is so much broader than just the in-flight experience, and she does such a great job of covering it at the Runway Girl Network. It's always a great opportunity to talk with her and follow up on it.
We need to do more ground. Well, that is an area I know we need to do more of.
Yeah,
we need
happens
to do
on
more
the ground.
Ground experience. Absolutely. Yeah. I will say that the in-flight content, I do feel that we're doing quite well in what we're doing from an in-flight perspective. An area that I would love to improve and grow is our coverage of the ground experience, for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think, interesting opportunity there to talk about what happens at the airport, even before you get to the airport. The process is got so many aspects to it and so many opportunities to impact what you as a flyer end up thinking about the entire experience. So,
yeah, well, agreed.
Maybe we'll do a whole show on that.
And it's certainly interesting to me to hear you talk about having people of color or just minorities, and maybe I misspoke there, but just have other people, diverse people, talk about the industry and write about it. And I think in particular, there's this person that I run into a lot at the club at LAX, and he happens to be a person of color. And I've noticed that people treat him differently than his coworkers. And I find it really intriguing that still in this day and age that that bias exists and people, you know, do not treat him of equal importance or of that stature. And it's bothering to see that. So I think it would also be fascinating to talk with some of the frontline employees and get their experience on what's going on as well. And again, it doesn't really have to be a person of color, but it could be, you know, for example, an Asian or a person where English isn't their native language and the challenges that they face.
Right. Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And the challenges are manifold. And I mean, we're just tipping the iceberg here too, because then and this is another subject that Max and I have been trying to explore a little bit here as well. You know, the disabled passenger.
Yes.
Or otherly abled passenger.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Let's hear it for us cripples.
Yeah. Hey, you know, the passenger of reduced mobility, the passenger, the blind passenger, the deaf and hard of hearing passenger. You know, I do think that it's easy for us to stay in a bubble, and we've got to push outside that bubble in mm-hmm. every direction in order to cover this industry the way it deserves to be covered. I mean, so that means – sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say my mother was wheelchair bound, and we flew all the time. And it was very depending upon the airline, was a very diverse way of how they handled my mother on boarding and not boarding and – seats and what, you know, and getting through the airport, you know, when you have a delayed flight and the flight lands in Chicago O'Hare at one side of the terminal, and you've got 15 minutes to get to the other side of the terminal, how do you handle a disabled person like that? So, I mean, that's a huge aspect that I would understand personally, having grown up with it and now being disabled myself. I can understand where, you know, and it's not something you talk about. The only people I know that do disabled really well is Disney, but they do everything really well. So,
well, I mean, yeah, but it's a great point, and your frustration is, you know, is well placed. And I guess I would be asking that question of the legislators who are looking at safety and egress. Are they also looking and paying hard enough attention to what is the experience for, you know, a passenger of reduced mobility? And are, you know, what is the facility for that passenger? And are you still having, you know, horror stories, because you are still having horror stories of the way passengers are being treated on board these aircraft? So, you know, there's a lot to cover,
But Mary, there's a lot to cover, but you're well on your way to, you have to start with the basics in anything. I mean, that's one of the things we talk about all the time on this show, and we do on UAV Digest, and I'm sure you and Max talk about it on Runway Girl podcast. You start off with the basics and then you grow out from there, and you've got the basics down. I mean, the core is there. Now you can afford to reach out to somebody who's disabled. Ironically, it's funny, but one of the science fiction organizations I know is releasing a brand new magazine on. And every science fiction story in that magazine will be about disabled and people of inabilities overcoming those disabilities in in a science fiction environment. So,
Wow.
But those are those things that, you know, you don't know unless you've experienced it, you know, and it's hard to talk about it to someone who hasn't experienced it. But I'm sure that eventually you'll find a way to touch base on that stuff and grow the show or grow the network more beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah. That is something I would love to do. Absolutely.
So I guess this goes as a call out to people that are disabled or minorities, that if they want to write, contact you and
please do. We even have a little bit of a mentorship program in play already, if you can believe it. And I'm being assisted by John Walton because I am only one person and John is now our deputy editor. And so, yes, if there is interest, please, you guys, well, you'll know where to find me if I'm asked for my credentials here shortly.
Well, I was just going to ask you for those right now, Mary. Tell us all where we can find Runway Girl Network and all the places online.
Okay, so we're at runwaygirlnetwork.com. We're at Runway Girl on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn as Mary Kirby. I can be reached via email at mary@runwaygirlnetwork.com. And if you go on to the website, you can even find my phone number. So you can reach me, reach out. And if you have a story to tell, particularly about your passenger experience as a disabled passenger, as a passenger of color, as a passenger of size, as someone who is outside of that white bubble that we're talking about, you know where to find me.
You still don't want my why you should look out the window story yet, do you, Mary?
You know, I actually, I'm with you on that. I love looking out the window. I really do. I just think that what's happened with the, and you know, this takes us down a whole other path, but you know, the IFE is a distraction. It's to distract the brain from the pain. I know I've said it to you guys before, but that is part of it. So, you know, they're trying to train your eyes on the back of the screen so that you're not thinking about the fact that you can't move your legs. So that the evolution that has occurred in terms of, say, the flight entertainment and all of that goes hand in glove with the evolution of the seating product on board the aircraft. But that's a discussion for another time.
Boss. Yes. Yes. Mary, I'm going to ask you to mention the hashtag that we all love to use and follow.
Yes, it's the PAXEX hashtag, P-A-X-E-X, and that stands for passenger experience, and people are literally using it around the world now, and not just people, corporations, but according to our government, they are people as well. So everybody is using this hashtag that's really focused on the industry, and a growing number of travelers are using it, and this is, it's a wonderful and a wonder for me to see, and it's exciting, and I think that we're onto a great start in amplifying the passenger experience voices. And hopefully it'll mean a better product for all of us down the road. We'll see.
Yes. Yay.
But please share and get the word out. Get the word out.
Thank you so much, Mary, for coming on the show.
All right, guys. Yay. Take care. Thanks a million.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye.
All right, we have a listener recording, a really interesting listener recording. Brian, do you want to kind of set the stage for this one?
Well, was it back in May, we had listener Nikki contact us, and she asked some questions looking for advice on what she should do in regards to flying. So the email that we got from Nikki starts off, "Hi, Airplane Geek Team. Nikki here. I've been listening for a short time and was wondering if you could give me some advice. I'm not looking for yes or no, just some friendly advice or input from the team. I'm in my late 30s and live in the Central Florida area. I was thinking about making a possible career change into flying. I've always enjoyed flying, and in college, my friends used to take me up and let me fly the plane for fun once we were at level flight. At that time, I could not afford flying lessons, and even now, it would be a stretch. But if you want to do something, anything is possible. So my question is, would it even be feasible to get a piloting job at or around 40 for a female? And do you have any recommendations for someone looking for a flight school or instructor?" Well, here at the Airplane Geeks, I think we are an opinionated group of people. And some of us wrote back to Nikki with various thoughts and suggestions. And Nikki has gone and made a recording of her first adventure into, I don't know, maybe we could say a possible career change.
Mm. All right, let's listen to what Nikki sent us.
"Hello, fellow Airplane Geeks listeners. This is Nikki here, coming all the way from sunny Mouseland, or in today's case, rainy Mouseland. I'm here to tell you a little story. In fact, this story hasn't even been written yet. And what do you mean by that? This story is one that every person on this podcast probably knows or has even heard before. This story is about someone with absolutely no time whatsoever going from zero time all the way to their private, maybe instrument, into commercial, and we'll see what the future holds for this person. And of course, this person is myself. I'd like to start the story off with a big thank you to the Airplane Geeks for pointing me in the right direction. And what they did is they gave me the information I needed. First off, I'm on a strict budget. Could I afford this? Well, they didn't say yes or no, but they at least gave me the positive feedback I needed to get started. So with that in mind, I decided to start looking at flight schools. Within about an hour of my house, there's probably 10. Well, everyone likes being around Mouseland, I guess, so everyone wants to fly around here. So I decided to look at the flight schools and say, okay, which flight schools work best for me? Which ones have the best budget? And I picked three. And the best way to describe this is the three little bears. The first flight school was really big. The second flight school was really small. And believe it or not, the third flight school ended up being just right. What do I mean by that? Well, the first flight school was fairly large and probably had about 200 aircraft. Had a lot of students, a lot of the state-of-the-art flight sims. They also charged more per flight hour. And since I was on a budget, I broke everything down by flight hour. How much would it cost for 1 hour in a particular aircraft with a flight instructor? Now, obviously, most flights run longer than that, but that's how I personally did my budget. With that in mind, the first flight school did not work out, but I did go on a Discovery flight with him. This is mostly because I know Max loves the Cirrus aircraft, and this school actually flies the SR-20, which I actually greatly enjoyed. But because of the cost, I had to step away. So the next flight school was really small, and I did not do a Discovery flight with the school, mostly because it had one aircraft, one instructor, and if that aircraft was down for maintenance or somebody was renting it, I wouldn't be able to fly that day. So I told the instructor thank you and moved on to the second flight school, or third flight school. And of course, if you know the three little bears, that flight school was just right. They had 5 172s. The flight instructor I met for my Discovery flight was really funny. He was young, a little cute. And of course, when I went there, everyone was very nice. I even got the opportunity to talk to the pilot of a T-34, which is not an airplane you see that often. I got to sit in the cockpit and talk to him about how much it costs to rent or fly, or even how hard it was. Now, obviously, a T-34 is not what I flew. I flew a Cessna 172, which is about the most standard airplane you could fly. And on my Discovery flight, I got to somewhat take off and fly the pattern. I got to do some stalls and slow flight. And I have to honestly say it was probably one of the funnest things I've ever done in quite a while. And once I landed, I went back home and thought about it for a couple days and said, okay, can I afford this? Yes, I made a budget. I got all the paperwork in order that I needed. And when I went back to the flight school to sign all the paperwork, the first question they asked me was, do you have a passport? And if you have a ominous music anywhere, this is where it would come in. Yes, I had a passport. Of course I did. But of course, my passport was 2 years out of date. Ugh, a whole 2 years. But I didn't let that get me down. I immediately applied for an updated passport, which actually got back in 5 weeks. And instead of moping around my house, being kind of down about it, I bought all my books, bought my headset. Again, I'm on a budget. So I took my budget and tested my budget for 1 month to see, can I maintain my flight lessons? And of course, the answer was yes. So with that being said, I spent the first month reading up on my books, getting ready for my first official flight lesson. And as of this past weekend, I had my very, very, very first official flight lesson. Or actually got to attempt to land the plane with my instructor taking over about 100 feet. But I got closer and closer all the way down to just about landing without him touching the controls, which is really cool. I enjoyed it greatly. So with that being said, I hope you guys enjoyed this little segment and maybe future segments as I tell you what it was like for me as I go from currently having 3.4 hours in my logbook all the way up until my private pilot, even my first solo, to my instrument rating, to my multi-engine, high performance, complex, and who knows what will happen after that. This is Nikki reminding you to always close your flight plan and have a good evening.
Wow, Nikki's on her way.
Yeah, I think that's so fantastic.
Now, is this a photo we have of Nikki and her instructor?
Yes, it is.
Oh, cool. All right, we'll put this in the show notes. Thanks, Nikki, for sending that in. We love listener recordings. We've said that many times. They're relatively easy to make, especially with smartphones these days. So we always encourage you to get your thoughts down, make a little recording, and send it in. And we'll look forward to hearing more from Nikki. All right, a little bit of listener mail. We get so much listener mail. Sometimes I think we should just do a show that's nothing but listener mail because we have so much. So we try to get to as much as we can. We heard from David, not our David, a different David.
No, but it's all because of me.
Go ahead, David. You can set this up.
Okay. 2 weeks ago, I didn't show up for the show. And we got asked by a client, listen to me, I'm still,
still at work.
by a listener about if anybody had ever seen at an air show an aircraft being refueled in the air. And I wasn't there, but Max asked me last week after talking about it. And of course, having been to the amount of air shows I've been to, yes, I have. I even brought up the fact that the Kiwis, or the Royal New Zealand Air Force, used to fly 2A4 Skyhawks and used to do a barrel roll air-to-air refueling. And then there was this, I made the comment that while they were plugged in, they did not refuel, actually. Well, this has caused all sorts of consternation, that sometimes they were passing fuel, sometimes they weren't. And Dave Underwood sent this to me directly via Facebook. David, just for the record, I got confirmed by Wing Commander John Bates, who was the commanding officer of the Royal New Zealand Air Force's Kiwi Red Skyhawk aerobatic team in 1990. In the famous video of the plugged-in barrel roll, the buddy tank was not passing fuel to other aircraft during the air display. So you are correct. Now, of course, I always like waking up in the morning looking at emails that end up with, you are correct. but that being said, there's some more confusion that actually Kiwi Red evidently at various times, not necessarily during a performance, possibly could have maybe did transfer fuel in the midst of that barrel roll maneuver. What I'm going to say is Dave Homeward has the Royal New Zealand Wings Over New Zealand, or WONZ, podcast. In a couple of weeks, he's going to have a bunch of Kiwi Red pilots on that show. And they'll be able to give you the answer, because at this point, I'm just confused. I just know they had two A4s and they plugged them together. Well, that was followed by my friend Bill Barry, who is the NASA chief historian and also a former KC-135 pilot. A barrel roll, when properly executed, is a 1G maneuver, so staying in formation is theoretically, if not all that difficult for a well-trained receiver pilot following a smooth tanker pilot. That said, I've never done it myself or seen it done with a KC-135. We all know that the Dash 80 did a barrel roll, but they've never done it with a boom stuck in another aircraft. However, doing a demonstration whiffer drill while in contact with a B-52 and part of the training syllabus in a KC-135 instructor course I went through in the mid-80s, a whiffle turn, just so you know, is you plug in but you don't pass the gas. Has a picture of a B-52 in contact, just such a maneuver. It's pretty significant altitude block, but smoothness of control was an essential agreement. The instructor or instructors in both planes demoed the maneuver. They did this basically in a 90-degree bank. having a KC-135 plugged into another into a B-52, doing a very tight turn at a 90-degree bank. I don't recommend you do that in aerial refueling aircraft. So we're going to end this conversation. Yes, people have passed gas doing barrel rolls in more ways than one. And we can stop sending me emails saying they could, they couldn't, we know it. I'll leave it as it's been done, and let's move on to the next listener mail. Thank you, David. Out.
Thanks, David. All right. We heard from Jim, and he writes, follow up to your commentary regarding reason behind biometric screening of departing international passengers in episode 461. Hope this clarifies things. And you'll recall we talked about the biometric screening that's been tested in some places, being implemented in others. And I think with Brian, you raised the question about departing international passengers. Why would you want to screen them, confirm their identity this way? Well, this is from Jim. He says, it's pretty simple. It goes back to the fact that the U.S. is one of the few nations without border exit controls. This is finally going to change. He writes, the mandate to do this goes all the way back to 1996 as part of the Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act and reaffirmed by the 9/11 Commission, which identified weakness in the lack of proper outgoing immigration controls to fully vet and close the loop of who is coming and going from the U.S. This was followed up by the 2004 Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act that explicitly required and called for the acceleration and creation of an automated biometric entry and exit system in the U.S. Interesting, I didn't know that. He goes on, while the DHS and other supporting agencies like State Department made big progress on the entry portion, the U.S. has been collecting near 100% entry biometric data since 2009. The exit system has remained a challenge to implement, with one of the biggest problems being U.S. airport terminal designs, which would require significant infrastructure redesign to accommodate screening methods like traditional departure immigration booths. Says, fast forward a few years, the advancement of technology provided DHS several new opportunities to meet its congressional mandate. So since 2015, it has been trialing several concepts in Atlanta in cooperation with Delta. Initially, small statistical sampling of international outbound travelers were subjected to the various concepts to capture the exit data, with testing slowly expanding to other airports in 2016. Now that, for the most part, DHS has settled on a single piece of technology that can be staged at departure gates to scan outbound travelers before they board, this final trial is being further expanded and is what is being discussed in media currently. And then finally, the DHS, which continues to be under pressure, plans to implement a final version of biometric exit controls by mid-2018, starting at the highest volume airports. So really want to thank Jim for this really good information. It really kind of explains it, puts it in context, and forces me to once again state that we've got the best listeners around, and when we need your help, you're right there for us. So thanks to Jim for that.
Absolutely, Max. And I also kind of got slapped over that one where I made a comment on the show that I really didn't see the difference between fingerprinting and facial recognition. And some listeners brought to my attention that really the big difference is with fingerprinting, it's something that we consent to, where with facial recognition, there's no consent, right? They're just going to scan your face.
Yes.
And I never really thought about that. They have a valid point. I'm still not terribly concerned about it, but maybe I should be. I just haven't taken enough time to think about it. But again, I'm very happy to get feedback from our listeners, positive or negative. So keep the cards and letters coming.
Yeah, for sure. I mentioned earlier in the show contacting elected officials concerning the ATC privatization bill, or the provisions for that in the House version of the FAA reauthorization bill. Ted sent us a copy of a letter from his United States Senator, Edward Markey. Ted is from Massachusetts, of course. And it's one more kind of data point to this this collection that we've got. This is probably the response that's the most directly addressing this senator's position on this, which is that we have the safest aviation system in the world. But despite the successes of that system, the president, a number of industry stakeholders, Congressman Bill Schuster, has proposed privatizing air traffic control. And then Markey notes that the industry is responsible for massive computer outages, sky-high airline fees, and shrinking seats, and they should not be in control of managing the most complex airspace in the world. Instead of this ill-advised proposal to turn over this critical aviation safety function to a private entity, he writes, the administration should instead come up with real ways to help rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. And then he says, as a member of Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, which has jurisdiction over the FAA, I will fight to promote the safe and efficient movement of planes, people, and goods in our skies. So, we're really kind of collecting these responses. If you have one from your elected official, send it to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, or if you're a member of our Slack listener team, you can post that in there. And just quickly, one final item. This comes from Mike. I think this is sort of a follow-up to our conversation about the getting hit in the face with a pie down in Australia, if you're the CEO of Qantas. But Mike says, a very long-standing tradition in skydiving is to get hit in the face with a pie after making your 100th jump. Didn't know that. I probably will never have a reason to find that out. Because I'm not going to jump out of an airplane. But Mike says, since everyone knows about it, it's a cat and mouse game with the victim constantly looking over their shoulder for the perpetrator. It's usually easier to accomplish after several adult beverages. Just to extend the tradition, sometimes your, quote, friends will try to do it for every subsequent 100th jump. Now get this, Mike says, I have 2,600 skydives. Oh my gosh. But fortunately have not been pied 26 times, which he says brings up tradition number two, beer. Anytime you do a first of something in skydiving, you owe a case of beer. Since you had all the fun, you need to share it with everyone by buying beer. It keeps the drop zone well stocked if you forget yourself and blurt out, hey, that was the first time I did that. Then everyone around you yells, beer. Thanks, Mike, for that.
That sounds like a great tradition.
It does, and, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been having this bit of back and forth with Dr. Steph over at Airline Pilot Guy, and she is a skydiver. And yes. So I've said that I will actually jump out of a perfectly good aircraft. But now knowing this, I actually have more incentive to do it. So I'd like to challenge any of our listeners here in Southern California, if anyone is a skydiver and or jump master that wants to watch me jump out of a perfectly good aircraft, please get in contact with me, and I will definitely buy beer for everyone when I hit the ground, or I'll pre-buy the beer, and that way everyone could join it if it's a successful jump or not.
All right, let us know how that goes, Brian.
Yeah.
We'll be watching from the sidelines. All right. That's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. We had a great conversation with Mary Kirby. You can find her writing as well as that of the all the contributors over at runwaygirlnetwork.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. We'll have show notes for this episode at the easy-to-find airplanegeeks.com/462. Brian, tell us where folks can reach you.
Oh, the best place to get hold of me for that beer is at brian@airplanegeeks.com.
and David Vanderhoof.
Oh, I'm sorry. David Vanderhoof is yawning. You can find me in bed shortly. You can find me on whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on Fridays at theuavdigest.com with Max Flight. And, of course, you can find me tooling around in an SR-22 at San Jose Airport. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Trescott. Or you can find me on Twitter at Jetwine or anything with the Jetwine logo. So with that.
All right, we're covered, except for me, you can find me at Max Flight on Twitter. I'm also on LinkedIn. If you send me a connection request on LinkedIn and you don't have an aviation background, but, you know, you're connecting as a result of this podcast, tell me that. Because if, you know, oh, I don't know, if you're like all your resumes in the insurance industry, let's say, I might not accept your...
Hey.
So I'm looking for the aviation connection at LinkedIn. But as David said, also at the UAVDigest.com, where we have a blast, and with Mary on the PaxX podcast, that's at PaxXpodcast.com. With that, I'll say thanks for listening. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find his compositions at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up. Bye!
And thanks for listening.
And when we do the PaxX podcast, it's 30 minutes. And when that secondhand start, you know, hits the, you know, usually it's 10 o'clock in the morning, bang, we start. And when it's half past, bang, we end.
Listening to the show, it definitely reminds me of an episode of 60 Minutes when they're finishing the, you know, the final closing statements, and you have the second hand coming on.
Yeah,
coming
right,
to
right,
the top
yeah,
of the
yeah,
hour, and that's what it feels like with the 30 minutes with you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but Brian, they don't have anybody going. Well, I just have one more question.
Fine.